Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There are numerous economic, climate, and security arguments as to why this region is not an add-on luxury to EU foreign policy, but it's part of the solutions to many of our problems at home.
You're listening to the National Security Podcast, the show that brings you expert analysis, insights, and opinion on the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. Produced by the ANU National Security College.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm Rory Medcalf, head of the National Security College at the Australian National University in Canberra. And it's a real pleasure to welcome to our studio today literally a special envoy, and that's Richard Tibbles, who's the European Union Special Envoy for the Indo-Pacific. And no surprises there. We're going to talk about the Indo-Pacific, about Europe's engagement with the Indo-Pacific, the challenges and the opportunities there, and also what that means for Australia. Before we go further, I'll acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land we're recording from and pay respects to elders of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, past, present, and emerging. So when Australia looks at the world and we look at the challenges in our strategic environment and the opportunities to build national resilience and build stability, we look to a range of countries in our region. We look to great powers for both the disruptions but also the partnerships they bring. But we also look to Europe. And I think a fascinating part of the policy debate in Australia in recent years has been to what extent can or should we invest in partnership with Europe, whether it's with the institutions of the European Union, whether it's with EU member states individually, or whether it's with the, the transatlantic framework of NATO and the alliance that brings the United States and Canada into the European strategic theatre. And how do we do that in a way that is reconciled with the great investments we need to make in the Indo-Pacific? And in that light, it's been, I think, really important to note how much Europe has really been stepping up in the Indo-Pacific in recent years, notwithstanding the confronting situation that Europe faces to its east with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, notwithstanding the internal challenges all our countries face. So, Richard Tibbles, you're here in Australia. Today we held a seminar looking at EU partnerships in the Indo-Pacific, opportunities for Australia and Europe to do more together. And of course, as a senior official and a special envoy, you're on meetings, you're on, formal engagement with the government of Australia and other governments in the region. It's great that you've made time to speak with us today. And I want to start by asking you for a snapshot of why is the EU so engaged in the Indo-Pacific? Why do you have an Indo-Pacific strategy? And how's that tracking?
Thanks very much, Rory. I'm delighted to be here. You just need to look at some of the economic and strategic issues which are happening in the Indo-Pacific to know why the EU is heavily engaged. It's half the world's GDP, 2/3 of the world's population, 70% of global energy demand by 2030 is going to come from the Indo-Pacific region, the region where we have some of the largest emitters of carbon dioxide, and also a range of countries for whom climate change is an existential threat. You've got the tensions, which you know better than we do, from the Taiwan Straits, East and South China Seas, DPRK's actions threatening the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, to name but a few. And we firmly believe that what you mentioned, Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine, is a threat to global stability and the international rules-based order. If a country, particularly a P5 country, a permanent member of the European of the UN Security Council, can violate the UN Charter and international law, invade another country, violate its sovereignty and territorial integrity, if that can succeed on the European continent, which we're doing everything to prevent, it could happen on other continents. So this is the linkage, I think, between our immediate concern in Europe and the broader security challenges in the Indo-Pacific. Indo-Pacific is an economically vibrant region. The EU is interested in partnering up with all of the countries who are going through the green and digital translation for which all of us have to get ready. So there are numerous economic, climate and security arguments as to why this region is not an add-on luxury to EU foreign policy, but it's part of the solutions to many of our problems at home.
And so proximity is not the only measure of importance in this relationship. How are you tracking, though?
Well, we obviously have our embassies in the region first and foremost, and in this part of the world, we're obviously present in Canberra and Wellington, also in Papua New Guinea and Fiji. But we have obviously embassies throughout the Indo-Pacific region. We follow closely and have strong partnerships with many, many of the countries in the region. Some of the sub-regional organizations we obviously have particularly strong relations with, being a kind of regional organization ourselves. We see a strong interest encouraging the ASEAN countries to work together. We see a strong interest in the Pacific Islands Forum being an important venue for the Pacific Islands working together. But equally, you know, we have strategic partnerships with a number of countries, and we are developing our relations by and large in a tailor-made way across the region based on mutual interest. We're obviously not doing the same, to take examples at random. We're not doing the same with Laos as we're doing with India. We're not doing the same with Bangladesh as we're doing with Australia. So we have our Indo-Pacific priority, and we are in deep discussions with each of our Indo-Pacific partners to tailor make the EU's engagement.
So you've spoken about the many layers of engagement with this region, and engagement can also mean really seeking, in my view, to maintain strategic stability or a balance of power. It's not all good news. It's not all just about economic opportunity or dealing with transnational issues. Much of this story centers on China and on the impact of Chinese power on the region, the way China's using its power, and some pretty confronting situations that a number of countries faced, including Australia. But of course, if you read the EU documentation, the strategies and the frameworks on the Indo-Pacific and on the relationship with China, this is also not cast only in terms of risk management or in terms of security risk. That's a long-winded way of saying, how does Europe approach the fundamental China factor in engagement with the Indo-Pacific, including in terms of China's own activity or management of China risk within Europe? How does all this hold together?
Well, the first point is the general one, that the EU regards China as a partner, a competitor, and a systemic rival. And when you look at the language that Australia uses, that's very, very similar. So we have a holistic view of China. It's not all bad. It's not all good. It remains a vital economic partner for both of us and for the rest of the world. But clearly, just as you've spotted the increasing risks, so we have too. So the notion of competition and systemic rivalry is much more to the front. We have now, basically since COVID came to an end sufficiently for us to be able to travel, we have really undertaken a strong set of measures to rebuild our communication channels with China. And this led up to the last EU-China summit at the end of last year, because we seriously believe, I think, that it is only by having a very, very dense and clear conversation with the Chinese leadership that they can be made aware of some of the concerns that we have, whether it is about the economic playing field, which is not level, particularly for the EU, whether it is about the Taiwan Straits, or whether it is about the activities most recently in the South China Sea. I think direct communication with the Chinese leadership is one of the most important channels. They're not going to hear it, shall we say, from their internal reporting from their embassies around the world. It's going to be from like-minded, such as the EU and Australia, telling them very, very clearly. So I think that's what we've been making sure we do to make. And then obviously the other part of the story is working with our like-minded partners to come up with coordinated positions. Over a number of years now, I think you've seen the G7 issue statements, which show a huge degree of unity on some of the challenges which China is posing. And this obviously, we hope, has a strong impact on the Chinese leadership as well. In addition to that, obviously, our member states are stepping up their naval deployments in the Indo-Pacific regions. There'll be a group of member states sending naval vessels to the Indo-Pacific this year, once again as a demonstration of the importance we attach to UNCLOS and freedom of navigation. This is vital for an important economic trading bloc like the EU.
And I correct me if I'm wrong, but my working assumption is that one of the big issues that the EU and member states is concerned about when looking at China is the, you know, the potential catastrophic impact of conflict in the Indo-Pacific if there's an act of forceful disruption of the status quo across the Taiwan Strait or elsewhere in the region. It's going to have not only immediate impacts but obviously global economic and other consequences. And I get the impression that there's a greater interest now in sending unified messages to China about really the self-harming character of that kind of disruption. Is that a fair assessment? And I don't know how much you can sort of convey, because I guess some of this relates to diplomatic conversations with China. But, you know, to what extent is this message being prosecuted in the public domain?
I'm not quite sure to what extent it is being prosecuted in the public domain, but certainly you're absolutely right. If there is one country which is going to suffer from a disruption to the status quo in the Taiwan Straits, or disruption in the South China Sea, it's going to be China. China is a major economic player which relies on trade. So if freedom of navigation and instability is imported into these crucial areas, it is going to suffer above all. And so this is a very strong message that we're passing in our diplomatic contacts with China, that China will suffer greatly through any unilateral actions it takes. I think that's a very clear message which we're passing, I'm sure you're passing, and certainly our transatlantic partners are passing.
And I think that's certainly consistent with thinking in Australia. One other, if you like, shadow or potential disruption when we look at the Indo-Pacific, because I do want to turn a bit later to the opportunities for really cooperating on public goods. But when we go to the the scenarios for trouble on the horizon, I have to mention the United States, of course, and the question we're all asking, what happens if we see a Trump 2.0 administration in the White House from the end of this year? How is that being perceived or imagined in Europe? Because, of course, a Trump administration would have very substantial consequences and potentially very serious consequences for Europe with regard to Russia and Ukraine, but it's also going to matter here in the Indo-Pacific. What can you say?
I mean, I think what we can say is that the transatlantic relationship is crucial for the EU, and it's had ups and downs, depending on electoral cycles here in or there in Europe, as well as there in the US. At the end of the day, it's always been regarded as one of the crucial elements of our respective foreign policies, our economic policies, and so forth. So, whilst I'm in certainly no way complacent, I still think that the vast network of links between the US and Europe and the EU will play a role in how things pan out over the next 4 years, without wanting to prejudge in any way the outcome of the election. We obviously see our other like-minded partners as crucial at the moment. So we are trying to step up our conversations with Japan, Korea, Australia, and New Zealand, precisely not only because of the inherent risks in the Indo-Pacific, but also because we consider, as I'm sure Australia and Japan and Korea do as well, having a range of partners in today's uncertain world is vital.
And we'll come back later at the end of the conversation, I think, to the relationship with Australia and how that is animated by shared values as well as interests. Let's turn now, though, to the specific subregions of the Indo-Pacific and the way that, that Europe is contributing and wants to contribute. Because although, as friends and colleagues know, I'm a strong advocate of the idea of the Indo-Pacific as an integrated system, and there are many economic and strategic factors that knit together this two-ocean region, it's indisputable that it's also a region of great diversity, levels of development, political systems, the character of different societies of the region. And so, for example, Australia's neighbourhood of Pacific Island states and Southeast Asia, and indeed the Indian Ocean, each have their different character when they approach regional challenges. How, from an EU perspective, are you working with the regions or sub-regions of the Indo-Pacific?
Indeed, you're absolutely right. It's important to treat every country as different and diverse and every sub-region in the same way. So taking it from left to right or west to east, shall we say, I think the institutions in the Indian Ocean are maybe less developed than further east. We obviously have very, very strong bilateral relations with every country in the Indian Ocean and South Asia in particular. I think all of us have developed our relations with India in a remarkable way over recent years. Economically, it is still very concentrated on its own domestic industrial production and is not looking for trade as an answer to all of these questions. So it remains a difficult economic partner for us. But strategically, it's absolutely vital, and we're developing our conversations with India. Many of our member states have burgeoning defense industrial relationships with India as well. India's relations with its neighbors are not always as harmonious as we outsiders would like them to be. But nevertheless, we attach great importance to the Indian Ocean RIM Association, the main regional body of the Indian Ocean, and we have just succeeded in becoming a dialogue partner of that organization, which hopefully will provide us with the means to communicate our engagement with the overall region. With regard to ASEAN, this is one of the longest standing relationships that the EU has in the Indo-Pacific. We're very keen to see ASEAN enhance its integration economically and politically. And obviously, we feel that the EU has best practice to offer to ASEAN, given our integration experience in the EU. But once again, the ASEAN countries are all different, so we have to treat them as obviously sovereign countries with their own national interests. But really, we've seen at the commemorative summit in 2022 that we held with between the EU and ASEAN, the importance that both sides attach to the region and our 10 billion euro commitment to supporting sustainable connectivity and green transition measures with ASEAN is a strong signal of the importance we attach to ASEAN. With regard to the Pacific, we've obviously had long-standing historic links with the region. Now we like you, regard the Pacific Island Forum as a key element in encouraging the Pacific Island partners to work together and form their relations with their key partners in a more effective way. We have maintained our levels of development assistance to the region, unlike other regions where we've had to reduce. So that's significant. So between 2014 and 2027, we will have committed 1.5 billion. But we're looking to move beyond, if you like, development assistance, looking to see how we can work with the Pacific Island partners in developing their economic potential based on the natural advantages that they have, as well as obviously, and this is obviously crucial for them, working with them to tackle the very present threat of climate change.
We'll be right back.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In a volatile world, Australia's strategic problem demands difficult decisions. Licensed by an inclusive conversation, the ANU National Security College is proud to present Securing Our Future, a conference like no other, informing a distinctly Australian, people-centred vision of national security. Bringing together diverse Australian and international voices, we are bridging disciplines, professions, and viewpoints. Join us in Canberra on the 9th and 10th of April this year to engage with thought leaders and decision makers from government, academia, and industry. For more details and to secure your ticket, visit the link in the show notes. The ANU National Security College. Engaging minds for a secure Australia.
So today we had a really, I think, useful public conversation, a seminar in partnership with the EU mission here in Canberra. And one of the questions that was put at that seminar from one of the younger participants, who usually asked the best questions, was actually about how do we come to terms with colonial history in terms of particularly engagement in the Pacific. And so, you know, Australia, when we engage in that neighbourhood, you know, we know that we were and are perceived as a former colonial power. But of course, there are several European countries that were very much former colonial powers. And of course, in the case of one European country, France, it's a resident power. It has territory in the region. But of course, that also brings with it its own complications sometimes. So how do you deal with this question of you know, a perception that perhaps there's almost a neo-colonial character to Europe coming back to the region to be helpful, but to be helpful on your terms? How do you reconcile with that?
Well, one of the great things that I've seen since taking up the job and since the EU strategy was issued a few years ago is the fact that this really has become a policy and a subject of interest to all 27 member states. So we have had during the Czech presidency of the EU Council a very active role by the Czechs to work on Indo-Pacific matters. We have had Lithuania issue a national Indo-Pacific strategy. These developments are extremely important because we like to think in Europe that we've left colonialism behind. This was something of our grandfathers and great grandfathers, not something of the EU today. So we regard the EU very much as a post-colonial setup where you have 27 member states pooling their sovereignty, working on a basis of equality, whether it's small or big, east or west. We have countries as well, and I think this is one of the messages that we pass to Indo-Pacific partners. We have countries who have suffered from empire and colonialism, whether it's Soviet communism, Russian imperialism in the East, or in a certain sense, British imperialism in Ireland as well. So the role of Ireland, the role of our Eastern, Central and Eastern European member states is extremely important in demonstrating to the region what the EU is and what it isn't.
It's actually quite a powerful point, because I think when the Czechs or the Lithuanians or some of the other European countries that have actually experienced, really the worst excesses of empire themselves go into the region, they can actually perhaps have a different kind of empathy, and I hope be perceived in that way. So I think that's an important point worth reinforcing. What I neglected to do at the start of the conversation, Richard, was to ask a little bit more about your own professional journey in this role. And I might just do that now before we move to some of the specifics, particularly about the EU-Australia relationship, because I noted when we met earlier today that your professional experience has been very much looking at Europe and Europe's eastern challenges and opportunities, looking at Eastern Europe, developing institutional frameworks there. And I guess in recent years, that would have brought some pretty confronting professional demands. But you've come to the Indo-Pacific, I think, 18 months ago now in this role as someone that is probably looking with fresh eyes at this region. And I imagine that you've had some surprises and learned a lot on this pretty intense journey in the last 18 months. I take it you've travelled a lot in the Indo-Pacific in this role, and I'd be really interested if you could share with our listeners some of your thoughts and impressions as you've developed the relationships in this region and travelled to this region and built this strategy or implemented this strategy that we're talking about now.
I think there are so many observations I've made during my time in the office. Economic dynamism is one thing that comes to my mind. So many of our partners are really switched on to the digital transition that Europe has a lot to learn, and this is a two-way street.
Yeah.
And that's a clear message, I think, that I bring into my conversations with partners, and it's something I take back home and emphasize to European audiences as well. We can learn a lot. Many of the technological innovations are being tested here first, not in Europe. So that's humbling, and it's a reality check that we need to internalize in Europe and build our relations with Indo-Pacific partners accordingly. Listening is one of the other things that I think I've considered important in my travels. It's also partly due to the hangover from colonialism, which I sense drives foreign policies of quite a number of our partners still today. So making sure that we come across as good listeners, treating each country as on its own merits, if you like, is extremely important. I've also, on this trip and these past 2 days in Australia, been reassured by the degree of like-mindedness we have, in fact. So those are three observations that I can make at this stage, I think.
So let's turn to Australia, and I think as someone who's focused very heavily on the Indo-Pacific in my own career as an analyst and as a researcher and as a policy thinker, I've tended, I guess, for many years initially to look at the neighbourhood, to look at Australia's expanded region, to look at the role of India, for example, and how we can engage more with India, with Japan, with Southeast Asia. But I've genuinely been struck by the like-mindedness with Europe and the seriousness with which Europe is seeking to engage in the Indo-Pacific, despite the situation closer to home. And one of the key elements there is really about principles and values. It's about the principles of a rules-based system globally and in the region. It's about international law. It's about non-coercion. It's about equal sovereignty of nations. And, of course, Europe is invested in this region economically as a really crucial stakeholder. And there's a bilateral, or at least whether we can call Australia-EU relations bilateral, there is that dimension to this as well, because if you look even at surveys of public opinion regarding political values, like-mindedness, in fact, between Australia and Europe is extremely high. Sort of respect for freedom of expression, democratic values, rule of law, equality, diversity, and so forth. In fact, in many ways, Australia and Europe are more like-minded than Australia and the United States when it comes to some of those values. That's a point that I'll make with plenty of academic data to back that up. So there's a big prospective agenda for Australia and Europe. And we've made some progress. And of course, we have to be realistic because at the same time, Australia's foreign and security policy resources are heavily concentrated in the neighbourhood, and that's quite understandable. What do you see as, I guess, some of the lessons we can learn from each other's experience, the Australian and European experience in dealing with the turbulence of the current strategic environment? And perhaps what do you see as some of the homework that we have ahead?
I mean, I think we are like-minded. You're absolutely right. We can bring different best practices to the table. I think the EU has huge regulatory experience tackling some of the modern challenges of dealing with the digital world. So I think this is particularly an area where we can exchange. As I said earlier on, I think, or maybe I didn't, that was in this morning's session. We both have had experience of dealing with disinformation, us with Russian disinformation, you and your neighbours with Chinese disinformation. I think this is really an area where we can exchange best practices and help support our partners to combat disinformation, build media literacy, and so forth. I come back to the listening point. You have tremendous experience in listening, in working with your partners in this region, and we regard you and New Zealand as very important partners to listen to when we are trying to engage with our Pacific friends. We hope that we will be able to relaunch the FTA negotiations, because I think it's important that not just economically, but for the overall bilateral relationship. It gives a strategic flavour to our bilateral relationship, and that's obviously something that we hope we can pick up on whenever the technical, political, and other conditions are right. And then in the security field, I think this is an area of untapped potential. We are stepping up our engagement. We have the latest operation in the Red Sea, Operation Aspides, which is designed to do some of the protection work against Houthi attacks against commercial shipping. So we hope that we are providing evidence of the increasing EU security role, and this will provide more opportunities for bilateral work together, I think.
If Australian policymakers or analysts or parliamentarians who are interested in really exploring the boundaries of what more we can do with Europe across, you know, the spectrum of managing risk, of resilience, of security, of development. If they're interested in understanding some of the big EU initiatives, what would you highlight as being some of the initiatives where we can work more closely together? I mean, there's an acronym soup of initiatives. It's sometimes a little bit difficult for, if you like, outsiders to navigate. But if you would identify a few areas where we really should explore more deeply, what would they be?
Well, first is critical raw materials, where we really hope that we can finalise our bilateral partnership, because I think we are looking to diversify our supply chains, and Australia is obviously an extremely important partner for us to be able to do this, and European technology can help achieve that. Our European security strategy is obviously something I would recommend to Australian listeners, with its three dimensions: promote, protect, and partner. Promote, that means everything to do with economic competitiveness at home. Protect, it's the measures that we need to take against unfair trading practices and unfair practices in general. And then partner, this is all about the diversification agenda that we are keen to pursue, of which the Indo-Pacific strategy forms a natural part. And just a final plug, if you like, for last week's announcements on the European Defence Industrial Strategy. This is a key element of our increased resilience in the security sector. We want to break down barriers between member states' defence industries to be able to address the issues near at home. But also we will want to see how we can partner up with like-minded partners in that field as well over time.
Richard, thank you very much. There's a big agenda. There's a lot of work to be done, but I think the staying power that we would like to see of Europe in the Indo-Pacific, of course, only time will test that. But I think it's welcome from an Australian perspective. And I can see plenty of opportunity for further dialogue, engagement, cooperation. So thank you for joining the National Security Podcast here in Canberra today.
Thanks very much, Rory.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.